Good morning. Last week, scientists off California's coast found that adorable purple cuttlefish. Who knows what other wonders could be found in other explorations, including by the Schmidt Ocean Institute's new remotely operated vehicle. It's finished with sea trials off Guam, and we'll hear about next steps from the Institute's Carly Weiner. And if it's Tuesday, it's a look at the world through Neil Conan's eyes. That's later this hour from the farm. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hawaii's Okinawans call it the Uchinanchu spirit, and it'll be in full force at the 34th Annual Okinawan Festival. And the Honolulu Theater for Youth's fall drama program builds on seasonal spookiness to make its own drama.
It's a Tuesday, August 23rd. That's The Conversation, and it starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We both saw that picture of a cuttlefish? That big-eyed creature of the deep. Yeah, it was really something.
It was pretty adorable, but, you know, it was made possible by the fact that you had a remotely operated vehicle that was able to get down there to see
it. Exactly, yeah.
And we're going to talk about another one this morning. Now, you know that last people around the world were captivated by that adorable, almost toy-like cuttlefish. Those little purple creature, those little googly eyes. Well, it wasn't exactly what scientists thought they'd find, but that's why they call it the search for the unknown, which will get some help from another underwater exploration vehicle, the Schmidt Ocean Institute's new remotely operated vehicle, Sebastian. Carly Weiner is the communications manager for the Schmidt Ocean Institute, and she joins us right now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
A pleasure to talk to you. We know that there are lots of other ROVs out there, clearly ones that you've been using before, the one that we saw last week exploring and finding that adorable little cuttlefish. Why design your own?
So Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor goes all over the world to explore the ocean, and we bring scientists from all different walks of life doing different types of research. And bringing on other ROVs like ROPOS and autonomous underwater vehicles has been great, but we really wanted to develop our own vehicle specific to our ship so it works really well with Falkor. And also so that we could be able to advance our science. We have 4K cameras on the new ROV, which means we have the highest, crispest resolution when we are doing that exploration and being able to see new and wonderful creatures like that really cute cuttlefish.
So the idea of creating something that would be proprietary to your vessel, but also one that, if it's going to start setting industry standards, might be one that others might want to have too.
Well, what's nice about ROV Sebastian is that it's very modular. So scientists can put any type of equipment that they want on the vehicle so we can make it adaptable to the different research that's coming on board. It's also modular in the sense that it could go on other research vessels. It was designed specifically for Falkor, but that doesn't mean it couldn't go onto other ships.
That's not your primary purpose in doing that, clearly.
Right. We want it special for our scientists on board.
So now you've spent a great deal of time off Guam and doing trials. Where does Sebastian head next?
So Falkor is actually transiting right now to Vietnam for another cruise, but we'll be heading back to Guam later this year, November and December, for our science verification cruise and for our first science cruise in the Mariana Back Arc.
And what happens when you are using this for the very first time with scientists? Is there some way of being able to standardize how they're looking at this or to know exactly what they're seeing, being that this is a brand new piece of equipment that not everybody has used?
Sure, and ROV Sebastian is our baby, so like babies, you're learning as you go along, and really that's what the sea trials and science verification crews are about, is working out the kinks. And so we have an amazing engineering team and Falkor crew that work together to try to test the ROV as much as possible. We did 22 dives this past July and August and spent over 100 hours underwater. So trying to see what the vehicle can do, where some of the hiccups or kinks were, and working through those issues.
What were some of those hiccups?
Well, I'm sure the engineering team can talk better than I can about some of those hiccups, but we have a fantastic and dedicated team that worked, you know, to make sure power was supplying well to the vehicle and the whole integration process. It's not a matter of just putting the ROV on Falkor and being, okay, we're ready to go to sea. It takes an entire team to do that, so we had to change some of the layout in our science control room. We had to add a docking head and some winch modifications to the ship to be able to properly deploy and recover Sebastian in a safe and efficient manner.
So it sounds like more issues with just the mechanics of getting it on and off the ship and being able to control it from the ship than necessarily with the ROV itself.
Well, there's always, you know, little things that we have to work on with the ROV itself as well, but also the training. So this is the first time that these guys were working with the ROV, and so they had to learn how to drive the vehicle, know how it moves in the water, and the best ways, you know, to deploy it, recover it, and, you know, the things that they need to pay attention to. So those first couple dives are always nail biters. You don't know how it's going to go. You've worked really, really hard, but this is the first time you're putting the 6,500-pound vehicle in the ocean. So I was luckily available and was present for that first dive. And it's, you know, it's so exciting, and to watch the pride on all of the engineers' faces when they get to see that vehicle that they've built in a year, less than a year, go into the water for the first time.
What about some of the excitement that you hope viewers will feel as they watch this? Because this is open source and people can watch what's happening as it's happening in real time.
Yeah, one of the amazing things is that all the dives that we've done in the past, we've live streamed on our YouTube page, and we plan to continue to do that for ROV Sebastian. Not only will the data be available through online repositories, but having those dives broadcast is amazing, because it allows not just scientists, but the rest of the world to participate along with us as we do these dives and to see things for the first time with the scientists.
What about the idea of keeping it not only available to people, but being able to add to the store of information? You plan to allow people to annotate these videos, don't you?
Yeah, and that's something that the whole industry is working on right now. You're collecting so much data when you're doing these video dives, and there's so much to know and learn from these videos, and being able to annotate it is a really important tool. So we have some things in place already on Falkor so that when our scientists come on board, they can, you know, go through the video live as we're diving and make notes on when things of interest happen. But we've also worked with several other agencies and organizations to help develop annotation programs, and that's something that's evolving and that we're working on.
Specifically, as other people are viewing this and thinking, oh, I know what that is, and start to put in their own notes, to be able to find some way of standardizing that so everybody knows what you're talking about, the same thing.
Yeah, in 2005, actually, we had a coordinated robotics cruise in Australia, and we worked with Ari Friedman and a couple other folks from the Australian Robotics Center in Sydney, and we were able to work with them on a program that they developed called Squiddle, and that was a public annotation system for coral reef benthic or flora images. And we had a lot of success during that short cruise. We had over 25,000 tags, so there's an interest in citizen science and public being involved in being able to help with these annotations and being sort of quote-unquote armchair scientists.
Right, but you wanted to be helpful and not a hindrance by having things that get populated into, you know, the general, you know, annotation that maybe won't be as correct as it could be. I mean, we watch what happens with Wikipedia.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue there is that there's a lack of standardization, right? So some people will see a fish and they'll call that a fish, or they'll call it by the scientific name, or they might call it something different elsewhere. And so being able to tackle that issue and create some standardization and checks and balances in those annotation programs is something that the industry as a whole is looking at right now.
And specifically for you for this next cruise?
For this next cruise, we're really just focusing on making sure that ROV Sebastian is serving what the scientists are looking to do on the ship. Mm-hmm. But we will have some abilities to look at what's happening and make notes on the on the dives and what the vehicle is seeing.
Well, especially as that's going to be used for curriculum to make sure that everybody's being taught at a standard level, I would think that that would be really important to get that out too before teachers start using this as, you know, part of their daily teaching.
Yeah, and we're really excited about being able to be in the classrooms. We have a Ship to Shore program where we have live Google Hangouts and chats with students, and that's been very successful because the students get to talk to the scientists that they're following online. We have daily blog updates and weekly video videos to update the students on what they're doing, and so being able to develop some lesson plans around the ROV and the different videos that we've already highlighted is really important.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing what comes back from that very first cruise.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. Carly Weiner is the communications manager for Schmid Ocean Institute, and she has more than 12 years' experience in science communications and outreach, and we'll be watching what happens with ROV Sebastian. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a community celebrates a strong cultural identity. Now, your backyard quiz.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we consider pizza. Walk into most pizza places on the mainland and you'll likely see something called a Hawaiian pizza on the menu. If you've never seen one, you might expect to find Kalua pork or poke on a Hawaiian pizza. But what the rest of North America calls a Hawaiian pizza is actually a normal cheese pizza with slices of canned pineapple and ham laid on top. It will not come as a surprise to anyone who knows Hawaii that the so-called Hawaiian pizza was not actually invented here, nor did the inventor have any ties to Hawaii. For today's Backyard Quiz, we want to know where the Hawaiian pizza was invented. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the t-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Hawaii's Okinawan community is one of the most tenacious in hanging on to its cultural identity, a tenacity formed back in Japan, where Okinawans are a distinct minority that has had to struggle to hold on to their cultural practices and their indigenous languages. Today, more than a century after they first came to Hawaii, local Okinawans look forward to one of the most popular and well-attended of the summer festivals. The 2016 Okinawan Festival is 34 years long, and Lynn Miyahira, is its program chair. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Lynn, and thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Chris, and thank you for having me.
Your newsletter is called Uchinanchu. Tell me what that means.
Correct, yes. So Uchinanchu is actually, it means Okinawan person in the Okinawan dialect, which we call Uchinaguchi.
Uh-huh.
And Okinawa in the Okinawan language is actually called Uchina. So you can tell already very quickly that the Okinawan language is very different from the Japanese language. And so we call our newsletter the Uchinanchu, the meaning all of us Okinawan people.
So it has a kind of an implication of being welcoming as well, yeah?
Right. So, and we're trying to make sure that people understand the roots and the history of Okinawa and that it is very different from the rest of Japan.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that history, Lynn.
Oh, I guess we could go on for hours if we wanted to. But much like Hawaii, it was its own kingdom. Okinawa was its own kingdom, and it actually was a tributary of to China for a very long time before it was kind of annexed by Japan. And so,
roughly when was that?
The monarchy probably dissolved around 1879.
Uh-huh.
So kind of close to the
really close,
Hawaiian monarchy, about the same time. And so, you know, it had its own language, its own culture, its own monarchy, its own music, all very different from mainland Japan. And so it really has only become part of Japan in the last 140 years.
And
before that, it was all its own country. So.
And in historical terms, 100 years
is
nothing.
Right.
Right. It also, what the history tells me is that it speaks to the whole determination to hang on to an identity.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So it is very important to a lot of Okinawans that we see ourselves as Uchinanchu or as Okinawans. The kingdom before that was called Ryukyu, which is, again, very different word from the word Okinawa that you hear today.
Sure.
And so there is a real need and a love for the Okinawan music, food, culture, language, and all things Okinawan, history, you know. And that's part of the reason why the Okinawan community, I believe, is so strong here and in other places. Actually, there's a lot of Okinawans in South America, you know, the rest of the U.S. mainland. They're all over the world. And we're actually having a worldwide Uchinanchu festival in Okinawa. This is something that the Okinawan government puts on and invites descendants of all Okinawan immigrants back to Okinawa in October this year.
In those other countries, have Okinawan immigrants done similar to what they've done in Hawaii, hang on to, you know, keep in touch, very close touch with each other?
Yes, actually they have, especially in, I would say, Brazil, Argentina, Peru, and of course the U.S. mainland, besides Hawaii. I'm biased, right? I think us in Hawaii, we do we have a very proud Okinawan community here.
Yeah.
But to my surprise, I learned a few years ago that Brazil has three times as many Okinawans as we do here in Hawaii. So
news to me.
Yeah. So, and they are very active in their communities. They have their own organizations. They have, you know, I've never seen it myself, but the Okinawan Center in Peru or in Lima has its own soccer field. They have done very well for themselves. So I think it's...
That'd be great to
visit,
wouldn't
it? The Okinawan community
it?
Worldwide is very, very strong.
You owe yourself a trip there someday.
I do, yes.
Well, but you know what? It's clear that being a sort of a... suppressed community within a larger country has had a lot to do with that, don't you think?
Right. So the reason why I think our first generation, our Ise, when they first came over to Hawaii, the reason why they created these clubs, and actually the Hawaii United Okinawa Association is made up of 50 member clubs. And those clubs are smaller, you know, little clubs that are made up of towns, villages, and cities within Okinawa. So people like my grandparents, my great-grandparents, I should say, came from Gaza, Yonagusuku, which is a neighborhood, really, in Nishihara. And they created their own club with all the other Okinawans from that area, and they used it for support. Sometimes, you know, they used it as a family gathering kind of club. And to this day, we still keep in touch. We have our family, our Gaza picnics every summer. We have our Shinanenkai, and so it's a way for families to kind of keep in touch and remind ourselves of where our, you know, great grandparents and grandparents came from.
And very specific town.
Very
by
specific,
village,
yes.
Village by village. Yeah.
I got to visit Gaza Yonagusuku, which is actually two little neighborhoods next to each other, and I was actually surprised at how small it was. I thought, in my mind, you know, there's like 200 of us here in Hawaii, and I thought it was going to be this kind of bigger area. No, it was really just like a few streets and a small neighborhood, but they are very proud of, you know, being from Gaza. Actually, in Okinawa, it's Gaja, but I think it got translated to Gaza as they came over. And they have their own little tug of war in this, you know, festivals. And so in Okinawa, I realized that it's very the towns and cities are all very proud of their own smaller heritage and their culture within Okinawa. So that's where it comes from, that in Okinawa, it's very important that you ask, where in Okinawa are you from? Are you from Nago? Are you from Ginoan? Are you from Naha? Nishiyama, you know, all the they want to know exactly where you're from. Kind of like how Hawaii people ask what high school you went to.
Exactly.
They need to place you.
I was
right?
just thinking of that, yeah.
And so it's very important to people in Okinawa, and that has translated into our club structure here for the Hawaii United Okinawa Association.
You know, it kind of speaks to something very basic in people, doesn't it?
Correct, yeah.
Wanting to know
where you're from and who you're, you know, how do I place you in the world?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it also means that, say, if you're from Okinawa and you come to Hawaii as a stranger, you're not going to be a stranger for long.
No, you won't. Exactly. Immediately, we do have a lot of visitors that come and visit our Hawaii Okinawa Center, and we try to connect them very quickly. So let's say they're from the village of Kin in Okinawa.
Uh-huh.
Immediately, we'll contact our Kin, you know, Chojinkai, which is our Kin club, and get them in touch with, sometimes they find relatives here. It's actually happened quite often.
That's a really nice dynamic, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So it's really neat. And I think that's one of the main reasons why the Okinawans all over the world have maintained such strong cultural identity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certainly sounds that way, Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much. Have a great festival.
All right. Thank you so much.
Lynn Miyahira is the Vice President of the Hawaii United Okinawan Association and the program chair of the 2016 Okinawan Festival, which is September 3rd and 4th at Kapi'olani Park in Honolulu. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio has the largest newsroom of any radio station in Hawaii. We produce programs that make up more than a quarter of what's on our air, and we provide two streams that cover all eight of our state's major islands. These are just some of the reasons that these Hawaii residents gave to their public radio station, and we thank Drew Henme of Honolulu, Jerry Dameron of Pukalani, and Sandra Tausaka of Kealakekua. Mahalo to all of our members who fill us with pride of place every day. You can always find us on Facebook or call us at 955-8821 and find out how you, too, can sustain your public radio station. And thanks. A Hawaii candidate for Congress has made demeaning remarks about U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, other Hawaii leaders, and Japanese Americans. The head of Hawaii's Republican Party has urged members to disavow her, but is the Hawaii GOP stuck with Angela Ka'aihue? Civil Beat's Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so are we doing the right thing by talking about this woman even more?
By giving her publicity that she probably doesn't need, that certainly is an argument to be made there. But let's face it, she is the Republican Party's candidate for the second congressional district. That's rural Oahu and the neighbor islands, of course. Tulsi Gabbard is the representative. But she is a legitimate candidate in the sense that her name is on the ballot. But a lot of Republicans would like to find a way to get her off the ballot. But the reality check today is that's going to be very, very difficult. Just about the only way for it to happen, certainly what is allowed under state law, is if Angela Aulani Ka'aihue herself removes herself, withdraws from the election process, citing medical reasons.
And so far, there's no reason for her to be doing that. I mean, one of her signs says, "I'm healthy, I'm cancer-free."
I know, and that's such an awful thing. Of course, obviously, Mark Takai we lost to cancer not long ago. Recently, Ka'aihue has said she's also going to run in the special election That's the CD1, right? First congressional seat to replace Takai, or rather to fill out the remainder of his term, just the 2 months left in office. And in that race, she has indicated that she will be running as a Democrat. Now, you can't do that. You can't run for two congressional seats. You certainly can't run as a Republican for one and a Democrat for another. And yet she is making these statements through press releases on social media, and it's really a headache for the Hawaii GOP.
And also for everybody else who has watched a lot of her remarks migrate to the mainland and to other sources. Is there any way of simply just, you know, shutting down and just not talking about this anymore? Because very clearly she can't run as a Democrat, as you say, in one race and a Republican in another.
Well, I certainly think that's what Fritz Rolfing, the GOP chair, is hoping people will do, is to not vote for her, to not. I mean, he's used the word vulgar to describe the things that Ka'ahui has said, and I think that's an appropriate term in many ways. But the reality is her name is on the ballot, and amazingly, she picked up more than 7,000 votes in the primary. She defeated another Republican candidate. So we'll see. Again, I agree with you that giving too much press to this lady is probably not a good thing, but it is a serious issue, and it's being picked up. Roll call, The Hill. I have noticed it in Washington, D.C.
And unfortunately, not bringing us a whole lot of great press for that fact. Okay, Chad, I guess we're kind of going to be stuck with this one until it's over, but we can all make some choices about what we want to pay attention to.
We sure can.
Thanks. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And now for our weekly peek into the mind of news analyst Neil Conan. There just might be a few stories you too may be following. The Olympic Games say goodbye to Rio. The FBI finds thousands more of Hillary Clinton's emails. The politics of compassion in Louisiana. And Iran bristling after Russian allies show off. Neil joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning.
And first of all, I got to talk to you about your immediate story. Have you been able to continue your harvest with all that rain?
You know, it's one of those very strange days yesterday where it rained everywhere else but here. Usually it's the other way around. It is really hot and humid, which is not great, but if you listen closely, you may hear the happy sound of nuts going into plastic buckets.
Okay, I'll listen carefully, but while we're talking about rain, President Obama heads to flood-stricken Louisiana today on his second day back from vacation. Donald Trump is taking credit for it. What's up with that?
Well, everything is always about the Trump in Trump world, but this time he may be right. He was in Louisiana with a truckload of relief supplies last week, I guess over the weekend, amid criticism that the president was unwilling to interrupt his golf on Martha's Vineyard. Now, the White House staff pointed out that the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, had asked them to postpone the visit because of all the disruptions that come with the president. But now the governor says the Trump visit was helpful. He says he's prompted President Obama to go there. He's there today, and Hillary Clinton will be there soon.
But amid all of this posturing and all the photo ops, though, the flood in Louisiana has caused such enormous suffering and damage. Shouldn't really that be the focus and not politics?
Obviously, you're right, but the two go hand in hand in some important ways. Disasters are one of those moments where almost everybody agrees that government has to step in and help. Now, George W. Bush got tremendous criticism on Hurricane Katrina, not so much for that unfortunate picture of him looking down on New Orleans out of the window of Air Force One, but really because of the dreadful response of FEMA and other federal agencies who so badly mismanaged the situation. By all accounts, the response this time has been much better. That, in the end, is going to mean a lot more to people dealing with this terrible flood than the pictures of, you know, Donald Trump handing out water bottles or whatever images we see of President Obama and later Hillary Clinton. But after, you know, after weeks of really bad news, Trump did steal the march on this.
But isn't there a huge issue that we're ignoring, Neil? I mean, this is exactly the kind of weather that climate scientists have been warning will be the product of climate change. Warmer air holds more water vapor. That means more and bigger storms, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And to bring that around to politics again, Donald Trump and much of the Republican Party deny that climate change is real. He called it a Chinese conspiracy. And I think the Democrats would be well served to emphasize that difference. They did somewhat in the convention that, you know, one candidate accepts the overwhelming evidence of science and one doesn't. But standing next to a flooded out farmhouse might be not the best moment to do that. That's a moment for heart and not for head.
Okay, you mentioned Trump's spell of really bad news. And since we spoke last week, he fired his campaign manager. He brought in a new team, even changed his tone a bit. And he even said he regretted some of the things he said.
But he didn't say what exactly. And that's going to invite a very long series of questions. But you're right on the change in tone. He had a meeting with Hispanic leaders and reached out to African Americans. You know, that what do you have to lose speech that many saw as patronizing. And again, images are important. This was at a rally in suburban North Carolina, not on a street corner in Cleveland. Yesterday, Cokie Roberts made a point on Morning Edition that I think was spot on. None of this is really aimed at African-Americans or Latinos who are unalterably opposed to Trump at this point. This is designed to persuade white independents and a significant fraction of Republicans that Trump maybe isn't quite the racist they think he is. The shift is being credited to his new campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway. And I think we have yet to see the influence of Steve Bannon, who left Breitbart to head up the Trump-Pence campaign.
So did Donald Trump actually soften his position on immigration? I mean, isn't that the heart of his whole campaign?
Absolutely. And if changing campaign managers twice isn't the sign of a campaign in deep trouble, this is. We're going to build a wall to keep out Mexican rapists, and we're going to bar all Muslims and deport everyone here without papers. This is the signature issue that has both electrified Trump's nativist base and repelled almost everybody else. Now, he's talking about something a little different, something fairer, he says. But, boy, it's going to be tough to retreat enough to win over some moderates without alienating that base, which is exquisitely sensitive to any sign of betrayal. And, frankly, I can't see Trump as being disciplined enough to walk a fine line for very long anyway.
Okay, well, I got to ask you about Hillary, too. She got some bad news. Another set of emails, 15,000 of them uncovered by the FBI during its investigation. Now the State Department's going to release them. So what do we make of this?
Well, those emails have to be scrubbed first to make sure the disclosure will not reveal classified information. So that's likely to take until October. Obviously, we don't know what's in these emails and anything that might be embarrassing, but this means the issue is live right up to Election Day. That's very bad news for Hillary Clinton. The email saga has come to symbolize all the doubts that people have about her honesty and her trustworthiness, about the pay-for-play connection between the State Department and the Clinton Foundation. None of that's been proven, mind you. The FBI that dug these emails out of her server obviously considered them. They looked at them in the decision not to prosecute. So there's not likely to be any smoking guns in there, but this looks terrible.
Okay, we've yet to talk about the polls, though. Now, last week, Trump was in something close to a free fall. This week, that seems to have stabilized.
The national polls have settled down to show Clinton ahead by 4 to 6 points, which is still substantial. Nate Silver of the 538 website points out that Clinton does significantly better than that in the battleground states. Now, it's not exactly clear why, but those are places like, you know, Ohio and Florida where her advertising has focused, and Trump ads are just starting to go up on the air. The conventions are well past us now, and this is the moment when most analysts think the polls start to become predictive.
So is there any sign that Trump's new campaign leadership that you talked about a moment ago has really improved the mechanics of his campaign?
No. We talked last week about Trump wasting his time in Connecticut, a state he is not going to win. This week he has rallies in Texas and in Mississippi. Those are states that he is going to win, and there's no point to campaigning there. This is wasting precious time. Time is running out. The campaign has not begun to focus on some of the basic tools of practical politics. It has nothing to do with ideology. These are basic tools, and they're not using them, and it's going to cost them, I think.
I want to touch back with you on an international story we talked about last week, the decision by Iran to let Russia use one of its air bases to launch attacks in Syria. This week, those bombers are all back in Russia. What happened?
Well, apparently, The Russians were supposed to keep this quiet instead of bragging about it. The Iranians called them show-offs and said they'd been betrayed, their trust had been betrayed, and kicked the Russians out. Now, one problem is the Iranian constitution prohibits foreign troops on Iranian soil. This is something you can finesse if it's kept quiet. But when Russia went public, it caused a problem in domestic Iranian politics. The Russians say the planes returned because their mission had been completed, but that's not going to fool anybody.
So is this going to undermine the alliance between Russia and Iran that's been propping up President Assad in Syria?
I don't think so. Moscow's goals in Syria are not exactly congruent with Tehran's, but and there is historical mistrust between these two countries. I don't think Iran much liked it just last year when Russia took over as the senior partner in Damascus. But Assad was losing before. He looks much more solid now. Both Russia and Iran have more important issues in common than this. I think it's just going to amount to a kerfuffle. It is a setback for Vladimir Putin's broader goal of establishing Russia as a great power. And I think that's really what really irked the Iranians, that he was, you know, strutting across the global stage at their expense.
Okay, one more thing, just one more thing. I wanted to ask you about the Pacific News Minute that we're hearing today, that almost 1,800 people have been killed by police and vigilantes in the 7 weeks since Rodrigo Duterte took office as president in the Philippines. What's going on there?
Well, this is a presidential candidate, a president honoring his campaign promises. This is exactly what he said he would do. He would crack down on crime, particularly the drug crime. It has to come as absolutely no surprise. When he was a mayor of Davao, the city in the southern Philippines, he was, if not a part of the death squads that killed hundreds of people there, he certainly encouraged that activity. He said openly that he encourages the public to take the law into their own hands and kill people. Mm-hmm. He at a weird news conference on Sunday night, started at midnight,
right,
said, I acknowledge that people are being killed, but our campaign is really picking up some momentum here. And he lashed out at critics like the United States and the U.N. who criticized these massive extrajudicial killings. The other point is, this is, at least right now, popular with the people in the Philippines who really wanted something to be done. I'm not sure how long that's going to last, because this is extraordinary.
All right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there on that note, but we'll talk to you again next week. Thanks, Neil.
You bet, Bethann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm, and you can also hear his specific news minutes, including the one we were just talking about, right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Aloha. I'm Marlene Booth from the Academy for Creative Media. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The Nature Conservancy arrived in Hawaii in 1980 and began working with schools, businesses, and communities to protect our lands and waters. Funding was set up to establish a number of preserves across the state. It built wildlife sanctuaries and enlarged our national parks. Relationships were formed with the goal of protecting Hawaii's remarkable forests and our spectacular coral reefs. It's these undersea wonders that signal the overall health of the sea. This is an area of prime focus for the Nature Conservancy, who also stem the tide of invasive species by standing guard, protecting our aina, of which so far they've helped preserve more than 200,000 acres. How do they do this, you may ask? They have agents standing watch. I'm serious. Not long ago on Maui, one of them swam through shark-infested waters to stop someone from shooting a monk seal. You might say giving your life is the ultimate form of philanthropy. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. I know you've been waiting with bated breath to find out about this pizza quiz. Now, we asked you to name the city where the Hawaiian pizza was invented. And a little bit of the story. It's not anywhere in Hawaii. The tale begins in Greece. The year was 1954, and a soon-to-be immigrant, Sam Panopoulos, had just boarded a ship bound for Canada. That ship made a brief stop in Naples, Italy, which is credited as the historical birthplace of pizza. After resettling in Canada, he opened a successful diner called The Satellite, and that was the birthplace of Hawaiian pizza. The combination of Hawaii's statehood and the tales told by World War II servicemen had given Hawaii a well-known pop culture image in 1960s America, which percolated to Canada. Pineapples, then a staple of Hawaii's plantation economy, were very much a part of that image, which is why this experimental sweet and savory creation was dubbed the Hawaiian pizza when it debuted in Chatham, Ontario in 1962. Chatham's located across the border from Michigan, not far from Detroit. That's the answer to today's backyard quiz. I don't think we had any winners, although we had lots and lots of calls. But there you go. It was Chatham, Ontario. We'll keep our t-shirt until tomorrow. Meanwhile, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
It's not too early to be thinking about Halloween, not if you're planning on mounting a thoroughly scary stage production. That's just what Honolulu Theater for Youth's Fall Primary Players Saturday Drama Program is going to do. Introduce kids to the joys of theater by putting them to work and lighting up their imaginations in the process. They'll be putting on a show called Creepy Crawlers and Other Spooky Stories, and Becky Dunning, HTY's managing director, is here to tell us about it. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, Chris.
What is it that kids love about being scared? Because you've seen this cycle replay itself year after year.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
I think it's it gets you excited, and it gives you a chance to sort of step out of your normal personality and react to something.
Mm-hmm.
And children's imaginations are just full of dinosaurs and monsters, and making somebody else squirm is a lot of fun.
Yes. I know. It seems to be almost universal. It really
right.
does.
And our program is different from a lot of other children's acting programs.
Uh-huh.
It's more process-oriented rather than production-oriented. So there's a lot of theater games involved in it, and we just want to let the children exercise their imaginations and stretch things as far as they can take them, rather than learning how to tap dance or sing a song.
The process of, say, getting into character, what's an example of the process that you...
Understanding what it takes to communicate effectively, whether it's using your voice or your facial expressions or your body. You know, when you're on stage and you're trying to convey an emotion, it takes more than just the words.
Right. Learning to project and sort of bringing everything to bear on that.
Right, right. And your body language, your posture, adding a movement or a gesture to what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
What do all of those things add to the performance? And making children comfortable in not just saying words.
What are some of the games that you play?
Oh, there's a variety. A lot of role-playing games and things like, you know, we want you to show me you're happy, but don't say anything. Don't make any noise. and there are all kinds of other wonderful games. I'm actually the managing director, so I'm not right in there in the trenches.
Yeah.
Dan Kellen, who is our director of drama education, and we've got two great teaching artists, Lily Brennick and Rachel Chapman, who are in there working with the kids, but they're actually in the classroom today. So,
what amazes me about acting in general is that something that you would do in the course of living without the slightest thought and find it very easy to, as you say, express the fact that you're happy without overtly saying or doing anything. If you have to sort of conceptualize that and recreate it, it can become very difficult.
It is, and you want it to be natural. You
yeah.
don't want it to be artificial. A lot of times when stage actors are doing television or movie work, people say, oh, they're too big,
yeah,
meaning that their gestures are too big. But when you're on stage in front of an audience, it has to be bigger, and it's the kids have to learn not only to make their voices bigger, but to make their actions bigger as well.
You know, in Laurence Olivier's autobiography, he talks about coming to make his first film in America, and everything he did for the director would say, no, no, no. Right? You have to back way off if there's a camera getting in close.
Right. But, you know, with kids, there's so much natural energy.
Yeah.
A lot of what happens in our program is we need to channel that energy into a cohesive production. And one of the great benefits a lot of the parents tell us and teachers as well is doing a theatrical production has to be a cooperative effort.
Yeah.
So the kids collaborate and they learn to work together. And have a common goal of producing this show. And that's something that it's hard to learn when you're 7 years old.
Yeah. You know, but at the same time, if you're frightened by the whole experience and you feel the support of your fellow cast
members,
that makes all the difference, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Becky, it sounds like a great program, and thanks very much for telling us about it.
Well, if people want to register, they can go online at htyweb.org, or they can call 839-9885, extension 704.
We'll send people your way, Becky. Becky Dunning is the managing director of the Honolulu Theater for Youth, whose Fall Primary Players drama program will be held every other Saturday from September 10th to December 10th. At Sacred Hearts Academy in Honolulu. It's for kids 7 to 11, and details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Beth Ann, I would love to be at the monitor when a remote underwater vehicle is creeping around in those incredible depths that they're able to reach now.
You're talking about our very first conversation this morning about the Schmidt Ocean Institute's new ROV Sebastian, which just had its trials. Well, the good news is you can be, because there are going to be lots of live feeds coming from that so that people can see it as it's happening, and that includes kids in classes, too.
Well, as I talked to Carly a little bit before the show, and as she said, the deeper you get, the weirder the animals get.
And that's the fun of it.
You bet.
In some cases, as we kind of learned last week, although that wasn't exceedingly deep, but good fun seeing that googly-eyed little cuttlefish.
That's great,
But now everybody wants one. You know, maybe they're starting making little toys that actually look like this animal.
Nemo,
That's the next conversation. No, not really. But up tomorrow, we are going to sit down with Carol McNamee to talk about MAD's legislative agenda. Yep, they're already working on it.
And a local trivia team wins big and gets a trip to Vegas.
In the meantime, you can be in touch with us anytime you like via our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217. or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can come via Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
Past shows are archived under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.